Welcome back to the show. Today I have with me Dr. Lauren. Oh no, I did not practice your last name pronunciation before we hopped on. Can you give us that, please?
That is Colenso Semple.
Colenso Semple. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited to have you on. I don't know if it just comes in waves. Everything in this space comes in waves, and we're just on like one of those peaks of the women's health menopause misinformation wave right now. And I just find that you are such a needed, I don't like saying like fighting back, because you're not fighting against something that I think is super reputable and evidence-based, but you're doing a great job in that space. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing, and find a lot of your social media content and podcasting super valuable. So I feel honored that you're here today, and I know the listeners are going to get a ton out of it.
Thank you so much.
Do the old podcast intro. Tell us who you are. Give me a little bit of your background, your schooling, how you got into, I was going to say making social media content, but that's not like what you do for a living. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about your background and how you got so passionate about women's health and what you're doing today.
So after undergrad, I had a kind of corporate job, and I started working in fitness just part-time, kind of for fun, because I was always really physically active and the gym was sort of the best part of my day. At the time when I had a job I really didn't enjoy, if we're being honest. And long story short, I ended up quitting that job and kind of going full-time fitness industry. So I had clients in New York City. I was a group fitness instructor at Equinox, and I wanted to be evidence-based. You know, I wanted to get the best results for me, for my clients at the time. And so I was diving into this literature and got really interested. And I'm just an intellectually curious person. So I ultimately decided to move away from being a fitness practitioner. And I went back to school. I got a master's degree and then subsequently a PhD. And at the time, a lot of these articles that I was reading, a lot of the prominent figures in the space were all men. And so it wasn't only that the science was being conducted in male participants, it was also that the scientists were men. And that's fine. I've had all male mentors and they've all been wonderful. But I was really interested in trying to bridge that gap and do more studies on women. And so I've kind of gone on to do studies in the more practical sense, like training studies. And then I've done more molecular based work, looking at protein synthesis, measuring hormones, but always from a lens of women's health and fitness related outcomes.
Let's talk about that a little bit I might regret having gone down this route, but let's talk about that a little bit. Just having this being a topic, this podcast, a lot of your work being around women's health, how important do you feel it is that there's women, one, represented in the studies themselves, two, women represented in the research field doing the studies, and then three, from like a science, science dissemination on social media, that there's public figures, people, women discussing these things? Because I think you just said something like, I've had all male mentors and they've been great. And from an evidence is evidence and science is science. And it's not necessarily absolutely, it's more important about what the truths are or what the things that can help us get closer to truths are. But how important is it, do you think, that we have women not leading that field, but being a huge part of that?
Well, I think being a woman doesn't make me any more equipped to do the work or to communicate the information. You know, good science is good science. A qualified scientist or, you know, professional of any kind should be based on those qualifications, that experience. So I think, of course, it's important that we have research in women and that we investigate some of these female-specific topics. You know, the menopause transition is a perfect example of that. It's something that's really difficult to study, and it's important. But as far as it be, you know, people only wanting to hear from women around women's topics, I don't love that, because to be honest, if we want more research in women, then we need the support and the buy-in from the people who can make that happen. And people who work at funding agencies and the majority of labs that are well packed with resources to move the needle. These are men. And so if we reject every time a man speaks out, then how is that beneficial for the ultimate goal?
Yeah, I posted yesterday just about weighted vest stuff. And I just know that I have a reaction post to the Stacey Sims, you know, on What's His Face's podcast. And I just know that there's going to be a percentage of people who watch that and who consume my content, and some of which is on this stuff, and I just aren't going to want to hear it from me. And I'm at peace with that. I don't want to just wage war on them, be like, well, you shouldn't care at all. I'm not necessarily going to fight that battle per se, but I just, I don't know. I want to have some sympathy towards women who want to look up to women in this context, but I also understand what you're saying and totally understand that, like, facts are facts and we need the support. And if it's especially ironic in contexts where it's a man, and this has happened a few times to some more prominent figures than myself by a long shot, where it's like a very empowering post, a very like pro woman post, and like still, no matter how empowering and advocating the post is, it's still something that some people just don't want to hear from men. And I want to be sympathetic to that, although I agree with you that we kind of are going to do the best for women ultimately if we're banding together on this.
Yeah, and I mean, to be clear, when I post something that women don't like, then I get the same accusations of being, you know, pro-masculine training or being anti-feminist or all of those things, which, you know, you have to laugh at that.
Yeah, other side of that same coin, or same side of that opposite coin, whatever, same thing there. Let's jump into, I'm going to say this, and I'm sure there'll be 1,000 tangents from here, but like, what the fuck's going on in the women's health and menopause space right now? Like, what if you had to, like, if somebody was just an alien came down from Earth and was like, what's going on with the menopause discussion, the women's health discussion right now, how would you frame it?
I think it's a combination of increased awareness and discussion, which is good, coupled with a realization that you have a vulnerable and confused group that are easily targeted by marketing. And so you can say, I know your body is changing and I know you're feeling so different and maybe you feel like things that used to work aren't working anymore. I have the solution for you, and it is a weighted vest. It is this supplement stack. It is my anti-inflammatory diet, what have you.
Yeah, yeah. The words that came to mind that I wrote down were like predatory and exploitive, and it does feel that way because there are a lot of legitimate things, especially when we're talking about the menopause transition where women feel misunderstood. Things actually do get harder, and they are just feels like it's a prime scenario for a golden ticket, for a quick fix, for somebody to come in and say, no, the traditional stuff's not going to work. It's got to be this one thing. And I'm not saying that population is looking for some easy way out. They're just looking to be understood in a space where I feel like for the last many years, decades, they've been legitimately misunderstood and continue to be. It's still something we're learning a lot about. But yeah, I feel like that is a shame. And every grifter will see this as an opportunity to capitalize on such a population. And it is a shame.
The other major issue that I see is just this misuse of science-based or evidence-based, and that now everybody says, hey, here's this paper in the green screen behind me, and trust me, everything I'm doing is rooted in science. And it seems as if everybody is qualified to read, interpret, discuss, and apply science, which really isn't the case and can be really damaging, because you can just pick out this one study, and I can give you so many examples of this. It goes wrong because you don't know the background, or you don't understand the statistical method that was used, or you don't know this paper in the context of the broader literature. And it's interesting because when you think about a medical professional, right? They're trained to read a chart in a hospital. The average person doesn't walk in and say, I can read that chart. When you think about an attorney and they're, you know, filing a motion, and the average person doesn't say, no, oh yeah, I can read and interpret that. And science should be the same.
Well, these studies often come with an abstract and a results section that are, you know, almost to their detriment, communicated in a way that is understandable. It just so happens that is there's some murkiness in that, where, you know, I'm not saying that everything is just muddied and biased and corrupt and all of that, but the idea that the only thing there is to learn about this paper will be communicated in the conclusion section or the results section or any single section, does make them, that information, almost too accessible. You know, I've had, just like you, I'm sure, a million of those scenarios where it's like, you know, I know this person is sending me this paper because they read that one sentence in the abstract, and not angry at them for coming to the conclusion they've come to. I'm more like you, just being like, yeah, that's not sufficient for you to claim that you fully understand this, again, within the context of the greater literature on a certain topic. And I'm sure we will go over some of, maybe specific papers, maybe not, but some topics where that sort of misunderstanding is quite heavy. Let's do some of the biggest. I want to go through. I mean, I was just re-looking over the notes this morning. There's just so many things to touch on, and so I feel like we could do a couple of them deep. We could go more wide and touch on them more briefly, and I think I'd like to do that because there just are so many of them. But let's talk about some of the more prominent myths around changes to one's health and fitness and lifestyle habits in the menopause transition that you find to be either particularly problematic in some way, or just ones that are quite prominent right now.
In terms of changes that are actually happening, or
that are being suggested,
in terms of what people are being pitched?
Yeah, that people are being pitched.
I think the overarching theme here is that everything changes and you have to approach your training and your nutrition completely differently. And that comes to, you know, your diet, this overemphasis on supplements. That's true for the type of cardio you should be doing. There's messaging around rep ranges that are required because you're peri or post menopause. So it's really just that, you know, everything you thought you knew, throw that out. It's completely different now. That is a totally inappropriate message that's leading people down these rabbit holes of chasing the next, what is essentially a fad diet, but packaged in science, or what is an unsustainable training program because you're being told you need to do sprint interval trainings and you've never sprinted before.
Yeah, so you're saying the more overarching theme is this idea that everything is different now, and that you need a whole new playbook. And from that, there's just all of these. You can look at every single section of, like, oh, your protein intake needs to change, the intensity of which you do your cardio needs to change, you need to train, you know, according to your cycle, depending on that. You can't fasted train, you know, you're at way higher, more risk of higher cortisol. And so you're saying before we dive into any of those topics specifically, you're saying, hey, the big more overarching issue is that the idea that everything needs to change black and white, you got to do a 180 on some of your habits, that's sending people for a loop a little bit.
Absolutely. And it's also making things so complicated because you're hearing these mixed messages about, you know, this is terrible, never do this, you must do that. And so people's heads are spinning because not only do you have to worry about 15 things that you had never even considered, now what you actually take from that and how you proceed is confusing. It's unclear. So, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? And how do I do all of these things at once? Because some are good and some are bad, and somebody else is saying something else. So it's really, really tough to navigate.
Yeah, I agree. I also think even layered on top of that is even just the topics that are being discussed, as if you have to do a 180 on them. And again, you know, we'll talk about some of these things, but even when you look at the totality of things you could be doing for your health, they are just still really small. And so, like, people are now not just confused about certain things, but they're even more focused on certain things that could be classified as minutiae in the context of their health. And so they're now really hyper-focused on little things and really confused about them. And that can be a place where you just forget to do all of the really... I mean, people think that that's some sort of false dichotomy where it's like, well, I can't... Can I, you know, just because I'm so super focused on supplements doesn't mean I can't also focus on walking and sleep hygiene. It's like, I understand that and conceptually that is a false dichotomy, but we have a finite amount of bandwidth that we can put forth towards our lifestyle habits. And it is the actual practical truth that people are stepping over dollars to pick up pennies and focus on these tiny little things and not doing the big rocks. Yes, in theory, you can do big rocks and little rocks and pebbles and all these things together, but that just doesn't seem to be how we work when it comes to our health and fitness. And so it is frustrating to be, you know, taking somebody as smart as you today, and we're going to come here and we're going to talk about whether or not berberine is the key to your fat loss or whatever, you know? And it's like, well, what are we even fucking talking about here? So let's dive into a couple of these. We can keep them relatively short because I kind of do want to touch on most of these, even if it's on the shorter side. What are some of the, from a supplement perspective, what are some of the things that you're hearing are super duper important now that you really got to focus on? And are there any truths to any of that stuff?
So I think that there's a misunderstanding of why we take a supplement to begin with. If you have a deficiency, then perhaps a supplement is appropriate. But if you don't have that deficiency, then we don't need to supplement, because it's not like, oh, more of all of this stuff is good. In some cases, it's actually the opposite. And so the idea that everyone should be on these supplements is probably not the right move. We can talk about creatine because it's very hot right now. Creatine's been around for a long time. It's been studied a ton. And we know that it is one of the very, very few, you know, exercise and performance supplements that actually works, that actually does anything. And it has a small effect on performance in some cases. If you're doing high-intensity exercise, it can increase lean mass depending on how you measure it in some cases, but that's not actually muscle mass. It's not like we're actually adding, increasing fiber size. And so that's important. Unfortunately, it's being presented as this sort of magic thing for muscle, brain, bone, and that every woman should be on it. When we actually look at the literature in older women, we see even less exciting effects when it comes to the performance side, a little bit of it, an effect for upper body strength, no real effect for lean mass, not very effective for bone. And the cognitive benefits, this is a perfect example of people taking science from another area and trying to fit it into where it doesn't belong. There's an exciting paper came out recently looking at creatine supplementation in Alzheimer's patients at a higher dose than your average person is taking. And that's true of really all the brain health and creatine stuff. These are high doses. And it, you know, some promising findings there. Now everyone wants to take that and say, for us, all of the average people, healthy people, it's going to be this cognitive booster. It's going to give me, improve my brain function throughout the day. And that's just such an inappropriate application of the science. When it comes to creatine and the brain, there are interesting data looking at traumatic brain injury, depression in combination with other treatments. And that's cool. That doesn't mean it's going to be this brain booster for the average person.
Totally. I think I crack up because I think if you boil down what creatine does in a training context, it might help you in an optimal scenario. It might help you get an extra rep when you might not otherwise have. That's just an oversimplification, but ultimately the actual practical outcome of topping out creatine stores is you might get an extra rep you might not otherwise have. And I just chuckle because the first thing you have to ask is, am I ever actually in my life in a training scenario where I'm fighting tooth and nail for that final rep of a set? Because if you're not, then creatine's not helping you. I mean, you know, I'm oversimplifying, but the idea is that creatine might help you get that extra rep when you're really fighting close to failure. Are you doing that? Are you ever actually in a scenario where you might not get one of those really hard reps? And with creatine, maybe you get it, and maybe that repeated over weeks and months and years has some sort of marginal effect. But I just like, creatine is not building muscle or bone. It's maybe helping you train marginally harder. And maybe that over a long period of time has some sort of tangible benefit. But you have to be doing the training thing to be really getting the benefit from creatine, at least from, you know, separate from the potential cognitive stuff that you just went through.
And the idea that somehow those benefits would be linear in nature and go on forever, and as long as you continue to take creatine, is just sort of that makes no sense. It's going to help you possibly, but though that it's not like those benefits will go on and on and on and on forever.
Agreed. Agreed. Let's talk about some of the you can't train fasted. You got to have protein before or after workout. You're going to hit be in some catabolic state, and all of a sudden total protein and calorie balance over time doesn't matter. It now we are like hyper focused. We're back to like the 90s of the anabolic window. Can't train fasted. Have to have protein in and around your training for women specifically in this case. Where did that come back? Because it seems to have, the kids would say, vaulted. It seems to have been something that we were like, cool, like total protein, energy balance, you know, over time matters most. And now we're back to like, oh, you absolutely need protein coffee before you train, or protein right after you eat, right after you work out. Absolutely can't train fasted. Where did some of that come back from?
The idea that it's only for women as well. I mean, honestly, there's no real human subject data to support any of these claims. And that's one thing that we really need to think about when we're listening to experts who are making things very complicated. Because if I'm going to make a claim that if you don't have protein before you train, you are going to lose muscle, I want to see the study where people did or didn't have protein pre-workout. And they lost muscle. That study does not exist. So that means that we are just speculating. And maybe we are speculating based on a potential mechanism. Maybe we are speculating based on a paper that studied rodents. But we can't do that. And if we're going to do that, we need to be really clear and really honest that that's what we're doing. And it's not what's happening.
So we have on that topic, we have papers where people train fasted and build muscle. Is the counter that oh, those are studies just done in men, and thus we do, because there's a gap in the literature in terms of outcomes in women, I'm going to fill that gap in literature with this mechanistic data from rodent data. Is that kind of what's happening?
So there are two studies that I frequently reference that are in women, and they show that lean mass in fasted and fed state training are the same regardless of state, and changes in fat mass, same thing. So you can lose body fat doing either, you can increase your lean mass doing either. The pushback on this will be, well, that group of women was overweight. One of the studies that was true, or these women were too young, and so it wouldn't apply to perimenopause. So that's the kind of argument that the people will push back on. And it's just really, really important to consider if we don't have that study in women who are between the ages of 50 to 60, would it be more appropriate to look at the data we have on the women who are 30 or the men who are 50? Or would it be more appropriate to wildly speculate that you would need to change your behavior? Because that's what's happening.
That is quite often what's happening. I find that the mechanistic stuff, I find the obsession with mechanisms over outcome to be just generally ironic, interesting. I don't understand how that could be. Like, you are in no way, shape, or form worried or focused on mechanisms. You're worried about outcomes in your life. And so I think a lot of people get really excited about certain mechanisms. They'll hear Kisspeptin, they'll hear about, you know, certain hormonal changes, and they're like, oh, this person's got it figured out. When like the outcome data, they're like, well, that's muddy. That's like it's men, that the population isn't exactly like me. It doesn't work. But this obscure mechanism, again, which might be manipulated in the way it's communicated because it was in rodents, or it was, you know, even mechanisms around in nutrition where people are given, you know, hundreds and thousands of times certain doses that are realistic in humans. I just get a bit frustrated when we get caught up in mechanisms when, you know, the outcomes are the combination of just hundreds of thousands of mechanisms, some of which we don't even know about. So I just find that if you're out there listening and you hear a really cool mechanism, you might want to ask, do we have data that shows the outcome that I'm looking for in this context?
Yeah, people will say, oh, you know, but Stacey Sims said something about the hypothalamus. And therefore, what she's saying to do is appropriate. And the thing is, when you communicate science in a way that sounds really, really complicated, it's easy to confuse people into thinking, okay, well, that person is intelligent, and so whatever they say to do, then I guess I should do. But the truth is, although physiology is complex, the actionable descriptions of what you need to know to build muscle, to lose body fat, they're really simply articulated. And so for anybody to pretend otherwise is trying to confuse you.
Yep. And that clip sent me. That clip really did send me. I don't even know if we want to get into it today. Let's see if we work through some of these. Well, you know what? Let's just stay on it while we're here. That clip was from Stacey Sims on what the hell's the name of the podcast? Diary of a CEO.
She said this on Diary of a CEO, on Mel Robbins, right, on Andrew Huberman, yes, everywhere. Yes.
And I think this is so basically what she said, to summarize, and I'd love for you to kick it back, was ultimately what she said was that women don't respond to calories in, calories out. Calories in, calories out doesn't work for women because of something, something, hypothalamus, something, something, kisspeptin, all of which will leave every listener more confused than ever. But in my opinion, the take home from that will be, the calories in, calories out crowd doesn't get you. They don't understand you. I do, and I have that answer. And it's not about calories. It's not about counting your calories. It's not about a calorie deficit. It's more complicated for you. Anything to add to that?
I think it's also being framed as, you know, what your husband is doing isn't going to work for you. And so the idea that your husband can make a change and he can lose weight, no problem, and you're struggling, that means that your physiology is completely different. And because of all of these hormone dynamics, you know, you need to make sure you're eating enough, because otherwise, you know, the whole system will kind of, and people have messaged me and said, I tried this and I didn't lose weight. And eventually I realized, oh, I should just be in a calorie deficit, and now I'm losing weight. So if people are really listening to this, and it's harming them from progressing in their goals and from, you know, doing these health promoting behaviors. So it's really, really damaging. And I never set out to disparage any individual person, but it really, really bothers me when you knowingly mislead people and you take advantage of them so you can put money in your pocket when you don't have the evidence to support your claims. And when asked, you ignore the other scientists and the other qualified people who really know the data.
I mean, you've had comments deleted. I actually have gone back to a post to reread something that you commented and couldn't find it. And I was like, wait a second, what's going on here? And then I see other people, which made me quite happy, who were like, who tagged you and said, you know, wrote on the post, like, why are you deleting her comments? And you're always quite respectful, quite literally just asking for direction to the literature from which these comments were made. I find that your comments being deleted is kind of wild behavior. No, like, why not block you? I mean, is blocking you more, I don't know, is that like a in worse taste? I have no idea.
I don't know. I mean, this happened the other day with a weighted vest conversation, and all I did was go in and say, hey, you know what, the studies that are looking at weighted vests, the women are wearing them for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why are you trying to tell people that going on 10-minute walks or 30-minute walks with a weighted vest is going to improve bone density or is going to increase muscle mass? We have zero data to support that. And then you have all of these women who are buying these uncomfortable weighted vests. A lot of them are getting back pain. And in some cases, they aren't doing the other things we know work, like lifting weights, so that they can kind of follow this trend. And that's the issue.
That is, in fact, the issue. The issue is that I just think that there's, you know, if something is additive, I think if something is a positive in isolation, I think a lot of people will find it, they will find some sort of, they'll be okay morally exaggerating that thing, because they can always fall back to it's in isolation and net positive. And so, you know, somebody will talk about, I had people, and I did this to myself yesterday with that weighted vest post, tons of DMs about it, about how it is, it's not bad for them. And it's like, yeah, it's not, you know, by the way, about a third of the people in those studies get joint pain, and that's only after 8 weeks of wearing it. And so, you know, we don't know what percentage of people would develop some sort of joint pain for longer periods. But I think it's disingenuous to not have your goal from a science communication standpoint to just be giving people the best information so they can make an informed decision for themselves when it comes to the magnitude of effect of an intervention. And I think one of the things that I harp on this quite a bit is there's two things. There's giving people information, and then there's helping them put that into the hierarchy of importance of all the things they could do for that outcome they're looking for. And that second piece is so important to people, especially in this information age where we are just inundated with information. And that's what's not happening. It's weighted vests are helpful, and then it will be taken way further than that. But it can always come back to, like, well, it's additive if you're doing all this other stuff. It's like, if you didn't say that.
That's exactly right. And when we look at other claims around, if someone said to me, Pilates is going to maximize muscle growth, I would push back on that too. And not because I hate Pilates. If you enjoy Pilates, then go for it. I never demonize any physical activity of any kind. However, if you're talking about, if I order the weighted vest, it's going to inspire me to start going on walks, that's an issue for me, because we do this a lot with health behavior. We say, well, I'll start once I get the right sneakers. Or, well, I'll start once I order those supplements. Or, well, I need to join the gym, and then that'll make me start going. And so it's all of these things along the way instead of just starting to do something consistently and regularly. So if there are people out there who are lifting weights and already going on long walks and they want to add a weighted vest, okay, let's just be honest about the potential benefits of the vest.
Do we want to just briefly touch on some of the studies that get quoted? Because somebody had asked me for what studies I might use to form my argument that it's not really something that is hugely additive. And ironically, after I sent them the 2020 snow study or whatever to be like, hey, like, this study is not showing us that, I know they did not click it, because they then sent me that study as a support of their argument of this paper being the reason why they're doing it. So when this whole discussion of weighted vests comes up, what are, if you feel like calling upon specific papers by name, we can, but where are people coming to some of these misunderstandings from?
The paper that is often cited compared women who were wearing a weighted vest and doing jumping exercises to women who were doing nothing at all. And this was a very small sample size. It was just 9 women in each group. And that's a really small sample. Of course, doing something is going to be better than doing nothing. And you can't tease out the influence of the weighted vest from the jumping. And there was no walking involved. So the fact that that is appropriate evidence for walking with a weighted vest is, again, just a misapplication of a paper. Then we look on to some other trials where they had people wear the weighted vests for 8 to 10 hours a day, either looking at muscle maintenance or fat loss or bone density. And first, we need to acknowledge that wearing a weighted vest for 8 to 10 hours a day is a brutal proposition. It's going to be sweaty. It's going to be really uncomfortable. And a lot of the subjects in these studies report that, it was not comfortable. It's not something that is reasonable. And so, again, we can't extrapolate results from that to, okay, I'm sure it'll be good if you do it for, a tenth of that time or a 20th of that time. That said, when we look at fat loss, it's another claim that's out there. The people who are wearing a weighted vest for fat loss is so minimal. And again, wearing it basically all day versus when you look at another study where they were in a calorie deficit or it was a calorie deficit plus weighted vest, no difference in the amount of weight that was lost. That's important. The other thing that's important to point out is there are some pilot studies that people will point to. And pilot data is designed to determine the power calculation or sample required for a future larger trial. So they are not even supposed to report their statistical comparison in a way that people can take away that was effective or that was not. And so this is really unfortunate. And I know that the experts in this field are really take issue with those papers because that's a misrepresentation of how pilot data is supposed to be.
Was that creatine Alzheimer's paper a pilot study? I don't recall.
It's very possible that it was.
I think it was a pilot study. It was like 20 grams a day, and it was just meant to be proof of concept for a larger study, and Max Lugavere posts it, and the world explodes. And so I think that was again, I find that quite interesting. I'd love for creatine to be a super safe thing that has cognitive effects. Alzheimer's runs in my family. I'm a homozygous APOE4. Like, I'm screwed, right? So, like, you know, I'd love for creatine to do that. But like, people in my I have a community, and they're like, oh, should we all be taking 20 grams? I'm like, slow down. Like, that's not at all the take home from this paper. You know, at least yet. Yeah.
Not to mention the GI disturbances you might get from taking 20 grams
true,
a day.
True. True.
A lot of people can't tolerate that even during loading.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you see something like pilot or feasibility study, that is not designed for us to take and run with it. And I think this is an issue when it's the same type of problem when we're looking at mechanisms. When we look at pilot work, that's not... The authors didn't intend for you to take that and say, okay, you should wear a weighted vest for 10 hours a day. And whenever we're looking at, oh, does this possible mechanism apply? Does it translate from rodents to humans? Often the first group of researchers to do that work will apply a really, really extreme intervention. The concurrent training literature is a great example of this, where they thought, oh, we identified this mechanism whereby endurance training and resistance training have these different outcomes, and there's this blunting effect of hypertrophy. And so the first, and that was a rodent-generated hypothesis. The first study to investigate it, which kind of coined the term interference effect, was a super extreme study where you had people doing aerobic and people doing resistance, and then a group doing both, meaning same volume, double the volume of the individual groups. No one trains like that, and it was an extreme amount of volume. And so, of course, you know, 20 years later, people have done more appropriate, you know, realistic representations of what concurrent training might look like, and we're seeing, oh, actually, there's probably no effect.
Yeah, no, totally agree with that. And in my hybrid era, I would rubber stamp that and underline that and think that, yeah, it's going just fine. I want to circle back to the Stacey Sims Diary of a CEO, and that clip is basically begins with the question: if you wanted to help a 200-pound person lose weight, would you give them different advice knowing that they were a man or a woman? And I kind of want to pose that question to you because I think that they're, well, I don't want to lead you. I'd like to pose that question to you and see, hey, if I, you know, take you out of here and put you in that seat, what sort of answer might you give?
Absolutely not. The same principles apply regardless of biological sex. And we have a wealth of evidence to show that a calorie deficit is required for weight loss. There are some considerations that are more behavioral in nature. There are some considerations for obesity where you really are having trouble achieving that calorie deficit, and GLP-1s might help. But that isn't an example of a calorie deficit not working. GLP-1s work because they put you in a calorie deficit because you're eating less. And so the idea that this wouldn't work is sort of shocking to me. And the evidence that she points to are these narrative reviews, which are a summary of the topic in the literature. And when you scroll down and you look at the references, we are again talking mechanisms and talking rodent data. where you're able to delete a gene or overexpress a gene or delete a receptor. And so the paper where it looked like, huh, maybe there's something to kisspeptin, they deleted kisspeptin receptors from rodents, and the female rodents gained weight and the male rodents did not. Interesting. Let's talk about what we know about kisspeptin in humans. There are only two human studies, and of those two human studies, it shows no indication that there is any relationship between kisspeptin and appetite regulation or nutrient sensitivity. So what are we doing here?
And even the discussion on appetite is interesting, because that is an indirect, that's an indirect thing. That's a woman might respond differently in terms of comfort level and appetite, but that doesn't discredit the idea that women also need to be in an energy deficit. I mean, so if her point was, and by the way, it was hysterical because, you know, I find that I'm slightly more in tune with this than the average person watching that clip. By the end of the clip, I'm left thinking, is she saying that it might be more challenging because women might feel hungrier and feel less good? Because feel less good is something I'd be interested in, but also doesn't discredit the idea that ultimately the right side of the equation needs to be a negative number, needs to be in some sort of an energy deficit. So I'm super interested in whether or not women respond differently in how they feel to certain size of an energy deficit, certain carbohydrate intake. Cool. Let's talk about that. Let's learn more about that. But the idea that ultimately changes the equation, and you said something really great before, which was there might be a difference between all this mechanistic chat. There's a huge difference, a massive chasm between that and ultimately practically what people need to be doing. And this was one of those moments where it was like, what you just said wasn't advice. The question was posed of what advice would you give? And there was no advice in that clip. There was just that there's a difference between, you know, the advice is that a calorie deficit doesn't work, which I don't need that. Again, that's not advice on how somebody should lose weight. And I just found that hard to listen to, because if you get me on that podcast, man, there's at least five to 10 huge things that everyone should be doing that we're not doing on a population level. And to get a chance to speak to millions of people on a podcast and not acknowledge that, if you want to do a yeah, but here's some minor niche fringe marginal differences in how women might experience a calorie deficit, low carb, etc. Okay. But it pained me to know how many people are going to listen to that and just be massively confused.
And it's the same sort of set of argument for the reason why women shouldn't train fasted. So somehow this hypothalamus kisspeptin nutrient sensitivity thing, like, that is why you're going to lose muscle if you train fasted. That's why you are going to wreak havoc on your hormones if you train fasted. And that's why somehow a calories in, calories out doesn't work for women.
Yeah. And somewhere in there, we'll throw cortisol. We'll throw cortisol somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Where are we at with this cortisol here? Where have we? I mean, we've been here, there, and everywhere when it comes to the cortisol fear mongering. Let's do a quick breakdown of some of the common arguments that are floating around there, and whether or not there are shreds of truth, and whether or not cortisol is ever something that an individual should ever actually think about.
The only time that chronically high cortisol or chronically low cortisol is an issue is when it's a symptom of an underlying health condition. And those are real health conditions. Are they super, super common? Do we all have them? Absolutely not. But if you do, then it's something that needs to be addressed. That said, cortisol is supposed to fluctuate and it is highest in the morning. It does increase with prolonged fasting. It does increase with all types of exercise. And then after the stressor, quote unquote, is over, then it comes back down because it is tightly regulated by the hypothalamus, by the pituitary, by the adrenals. And so it's not something that we need to worry about. We don't need to do something different behaviorally or manually shift. Just like we don't with any of the other hormone fluctuations that are going on throughout the day. You know, it's funny that we only talk about cortisol, but should we all be worrying about insulin every time we eat? maybe if you're diabetic, but certainly not if you're not. Do we need to be worried about our testosterone fluctuations throughout the day? What about our estradiol fluctuations throughout the month? Like, can we feel when we have a spike in luteinizing hormone? Of course not. Like, none of this. I mean, if we actually did have to manually fix every single hormone fluctuation, we wouldn't be functional as humans. And so this is fear-based messaging designed to sell you something, whether it's a supplement to fix your cortisol or a special diet, because apparently, you know, it's cortisol belly and it's not about being in a calorie deficit. All of this is just nonsense. And it's, again, just designed to confuse you, because hormones are confusing and complicated. And so when you hear that and it sounds compelling, like, well, cortisol is bad, so we wouldn't want to do things that increase our cortisol. No. Exercise is excellent. It happens to come with an increase in cortisol that we do not have to worry about.
I think when it comes to cortisol and insulin, they suffer from the same issue, which is that you could say something factually true about them that sounds scary. And so you could say, oh, insulin's a fat storage hormone. And you could just say that. You could, oh, insulin's the storage hormone. You could just say that, and all of a sudden, I have people bought into the idea that insulin's bad. You can find some shred of cortisol and fat redistribution in the abdomen, and you can make a logical, true statement about it. And then I can make money off that, let's just say. Some between me saying it, there's a direct line between that and your pocket and your wallet. And I think that they both suffer from that when it's like, well, yeah, that's true, but ultimately isn't something that you need to be micromanaging.
Yeah, and again, I think we need to focus on, what do you do? What is the advice here? And is the advice at the end of the message something that sounds overly complicated? Does it sound too good to be true? Does it sound like this quick fix? Is it an overemphasis on a supplement? Is it an overemphasis on one very complicated or expensive diet? Run.
Let's talk about sprinting for a second. Sprinting is the, like, wooden cutting board of the, it's just like this appeal to, like, returning to what our ancestors did. It's like, it's primal. It's like, there's something about sprinting that just, like, I'm like one or two pieces of a flowchart away from, like, a dude in a field with his shoes off in the grass. It's getting connecting with nature. It's like, sprinting's natural. Sorry for that tangent, but that's just something that I've been seeing. Let's talk about the suggestion that women should do sprint interval training for some unique benefit.
I don't think anybody should do sprint interval training unless they have really excellent running mechanics and sprint mechanics, because it can really suscept you to injury. And then you're not going to be able to do any exercise at all. For the few people who have great sprint mechanics and enjoy sprinting, then great. But the idea that this is required for women, or for particularly women who are peri-post-menopause, no evidence to support that. If we're talking about just physical activity in general, then do what you enjoy. So if that's lower intensity cardio, moderate intensity, higher intensity, incline walking on a treadmill, going for a hike, all of it is good. Do what you will be able to do sustainably over the long term. When it comes to fat loss, there's nothing magic about HIIT or sprint intervals for fat loss. The unfortunate reality is the fat loss benefits we're getting from any kind of cardio are so minimal. We have to focus on the diet if fat loss is the goal.
Yeah, I love that. I love that piece about the fat loss. The thing that I find interesting about the sprinting is that two things. One is the obsession with, like, muscle being built sprinting. And it's like, to me, that's like cutting your steak with a fork. It's like, you know, like, we could do that, but, like, we have, like, a knife right there. And if you look at the research where people do sprint interval training, I have two huge problems with it. One is sprint interval training, it could be anything. It could be 4-minute intervals. It could be 8-second intervals with, like, true. You made a wonderful point that you led with, is that most people cannot sprint. You cannot safely sprint. You know, sprinting in air quotes, meaning just like all near all out efforts on potentially other modalities, bikes, more safer places for you to do sprinting. Like, that's one thing. But if you look at the literature, sprinting is everything from like 3 to 4 minute intervals to like 8-second intervals, full recovery, not full recovery. There's like Tabata protocols that people think are sprinting. Like, Tabata is not sprinting. And some people build muscle. The people build muscle are, you know, overweight, sedentary intervals, individuals compared to control doing nothing. And, you know, we see people do incline walking and build muscle. It does not mean that that's like that all of a sudden is a reason we should do it. And then there's the women should polarize, right? This moderate intensity is not great. But like, if you're telling me women should polarize, and then you're telling me that women should do sprinting and lifting on a continuum of intensities are quite similar. They're more, way more similar than lifting and walking, right? Or lifting in zone two cardio. And so the same person who's telling you not to do zone two because you should polarize is also telling you to do two things that I think have more, way more overlap, lifting and sprinting. If you wanted to really polarize, you'd be doing, you know, high intensity lifting / sprinting and low intensity zone two. But this same person is saying you shouldn't do zone two. So those have been some of my gripes with the pro sprinting rhetoric.
Yeah, to piggyback off of a couple of things you just said, if we go from doing absolutely nothing to doing anything at all, we do see a small amount of muscle growth. That doesn't mean that activity is a good muscle building activity. And so we need to be really careful about making that distinction. The other thing, to your point, when you're trying to do sprint interval training and lift weights, you know what makes you really, really sore? Sprint interval training. And so it's very likely that that is going to, especially early on, you're going to have some trouble with the recovery from that training when you go in and you try to do some leg exercises in the gym.
Totally. The study that people will send me is the effect of sprint interval training on body comp of postmenopausal women. It's an 8-week study. 40 overweight, sedentary menopausal women. Half of them did sprint interval training. Half of them did nothing. And the intervention was 3 times a week sprint interval training of 8-second all-out sprint and 12-second of light pedaling. I just want to be very clear. Within the first 3 rounds of that, you're no longer sprinting. This is moderate intensity cardio from an intensity. You will be very tired, but the actual, from, if you measure power output, you measure how hard people are able to work. Once you're like 3-4 minutes into this, it's 20 minutes of that. 20 minutes of 8-second all-out sprint and then 12-second recovery. If I'm programming, I have someone who wants to really improve their 800 meter and their mile time. We're doing some sprints. If you're doing real sprint interval, you're doing like, a 1 to 4, you know, something like that, where it's a much longer rest period. So if you want to say, hey, these postmenopausal women saw great, amazing results, which I would attest, you know, or contest, this is moderate intensity cardio. This is not sprinting. Yeah. Oh, well.
And we, again, have to be careful there, because when we compare doing something to doing nothing, that's not an argument for why this thing is better than that other intensity or that other type of exercise. You need to compare those two types of exercises head on for the outcome of interest if you're going to make claims about something being better than something else.
Yeah, and it goes back to the jumping with the weighted vest versus nothing. It's like, well, if you just took jumping against nothing, I bet you we see improvements in bone density. Jumping's cool, you know? What else is out there that, I don't want to say grinds your gears, like you're just some like person on the internet who's getting bothered by all this shit, but, you know, on some level we are. But what else is out there that maybe we missed that you feel is a battle you're fighting, or is a piece of advice or something women should know that you don't think is getting amplified enough?
I think we need more conversation around why women, especially in the menopause transition, feel like things don't work anymore, and why they are buying into this messaging that you need to flip the switch and you need a whole new blueprint for health. And I think it's important to acknowledge that people who are experiencing symptoms during menopause have potential downstream effects that could affect your diet, your exercise habits, your overall physical activity. If you're not sleeping properly, then that could be huge. And during this stage of life, it's also possible you're making kind of inadvertent changes that are going to end up affecting body composition. So we need to just be honest about kind of how those changes are coming about. And then more importantly, what can we do that to address them that is going to be effective? And I think when we talk about the different lived experiences of men and women, or we talk about making those changes and, you know, my husband changed this and I did the same thing and it worked for him and it didn't work for me, we also need to remember that maybe your husband is a larger person who can eat a higher maintenance calories than you. And maybe you're cooking dinner together or you're going out together and you're eating similar portions. And so that's something that I think we're often missing, because when you look at, oh, does the calorie deficit work for him versus is it working for me? Well, if he started at a higher place, then he has more room. And so maybe that calorie deficit is going to feel easier for him. Maybe he'll still be able to keep in the ice cream and the whiskey and whatever, and then but you won't, because you started from a lower place in terms of your maintenance calories, and so it's going to feel more difficult. It doesn't mean that the same principles don't apply.
Yeah, I think that's super well said. I go through periods where I post a lot about what I eat, and I haven't tracked in a long time, but recently I'm tracking for a niche purpose of making sure I'm eating enough carbs for running, et cetera. And I get messages of people like, wow, it must be nice. You get to eat 3,700 calories. And my knee jerk is like, I'm just as satisfied or unsatisfied with my 37 as you are with your 17 or 19 or 2,000 or 2,200. At the end of the day, I'm just as satiated or not. I'm just as much. If you ask me, would I love more food? I'm answering yes, just like you are. My hunger signaling is higher, and I don't want to just say, oh, it's all relative, it's all the same, because there is one thing that you brought up that is not relative, which is the world and the environment we live in. And so if we, you know, portion sizes are not scaled down to a person's energy needs. They are most of the time pretty, unless you're a child and it's like, you know, a child's kids menu. There's no like. You know, I always imagine a world where like AI, you know, you plug in your calorie maintenance when you get to a restaurant and they scale the portion down perfectly. I think that would solve, if I order a burger and you order a burger, like I can still go out to eat and have a 1500 calorie restaurant meal without it completely blowing up my day. And I think that, you know, I can still get a dessert and split the dessert. If my wife and I split a dessert, that's not a 50-50 split, right? It's a much smaller percentage of my total calorie intake. And I feel like that is one place where having more calories does make life easier, but it's certainly not, it's making life easier. It's not changing necessarily the physiological equation.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so I think it's important to be honest about how we can achieve that deficit in a way that is sustainable and reasonable and doesn't feel overly restrictive. And there are plenty of people who are putting out, you know, great tips about that without saying, oh, and you must eat this food or you must not never eat this food. Like we have to get away from the black and white, this is amazing and this is awful, because that's not sustainable advice. And the problem is that people aren't doing the things that work, and that's why they're so frustrated. And then we have all of this noise in the space that's getting you to focus on these other things that, as you said earlier, maybe they're going to make that 1% difference if you are doing the big things that really move the needle. But we're just forgetting about the big things that really work.
Yeah. There's too many things being thrown at somebody without the additional context of how important each thing is. I think that can be a real challenge for, I don't want to say the average person in some sort of condescending way, but I think that's not the average person's job to be able to disseminate exactly, to put these things perfectly in a hierarchy of importance of what to do. And I find that to be part of, yeah, that's a lot of what I do with coaching is like people, I do a lot more of, you shouldn't worry so much about that, than I do, you know, helping people understand like really intricate things. It's like, how about you just don't worry about those 15 things you were worrying about when you came here, and we have these three or four things that are going to move the needle quite a bit. Do you find that similar? Are you working with people on an individual level? What are you doing more on a day-to-day basis?
I'm not working with many people on an individual level anymore, although I used to do that. Now I'm trying to work more with people who are working with others, so it can be a larger downstream effect. But I think it's really important that we understand that not everybody on the internet is educated in exercise and nutrition. And I it's not about having a PhD. It's not even about having a master's degree. There are excellent fitness professionals who are educated because they've made it a point to actually learn that information, because there's a lot of, oh, I'm a doctor and therefore I know everything about exercise and nutrition, or I'm qualified to write a book or to disseminate information, programming. And being a medical doctor actually doesn't make you at all qualified to talk about exercise or nutrition. And it's very unfortunate because they should have that education. It's unfortunate that they don't, because plenty of people are going to their physician and saying, you know, I need to lose weight. What should I do? Or I'm not working out. Do you have any suggestions? And they're not equipped with the tools to properly guide them. So if we think about Instagram and what's going on in that arena of people automatically trusting the MD about pretty much everything, we need to remember that experts are experts in a niche, but that doesn't mean you can be an expert in all facets. And there's a lot of that going on where people are really not staying in their lane, but not getting checked for it because you can say, I'm a doctor.
I want to be respectful of your time. You've been super generous, and I'll let you get out of here in 1 second. I want to just ask one little question of, in the context of checking people, have you offered, I don't love the word debate, but that is technically what it is. I mean, I would give anything. I would contribute monetarily to certain debates for the good of mankind, for the good of myself. I find it incredibly interesting to hear people debate, and that itself can be confusing sometimes. But I'm thinking of a debate recently on Dr. Mike's podcast between Dr. Andrea Love and somebody else. And even like an untrained eye that's like not necessarily in the space, I think you are still left with some really good takeaways about who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't. And I think that I just wish that happened more often. Is that something that you've offered?
Absolutely. Privately and publicly.
Well, it's unfortunate that it hasn't happened, but I will keep my fingers crossed.
Yeah, I'm very open to it. I think discussing the science is what makes us better scientists. And if we have a disagreement about, you know, interpretation of data, that happens all the time. And that's something that you can have a healthy discourse, and that's good. That's not really what's going on here.
Yeah. There's just a very simple reason why somebody would dodge that offer. And I'm seeing it happening right now with the low carb keto lean mass hyper responder crowd, and a lot of them have been offered. And so I'm realizing that we're probably not going to get that because it just doesn't monetarily benefit let's say both parties, and so that's a shame. But yeah, if it does happen, then that would be fantastic. We'll wrap up with where can people get, you know, you mentioned maybe doing more of the coaching, I don't say coaching coaches, but disseminating to one level higher up than the lay person. Where can people interact with that information from you, or can they get that information, connect with you and what you do, and learn more?
Yeah, so you can check out my Instagram, Dr. Lauren CS1. If you're somebody who's more of a research nerd and you want those high level intricate breakdowns such that you don't have to try to read the paper yourself, check out Mass Research Review. If you're interested in lighthearted chat about silly fitness headlines, check out Front Page Fitness, a new podcast that I have with my colleague Eric Trexler. And you can go to my website, drlaurencs.com.
Sweet. Amazing. I have not listened to that podcast with Eric. Eric's been on the podcast before. I love Eric. I'm sure you guys are going to do a great job.
Thank you. Yeah, we're having fun. We're trying to kind of keep it light, but with a little bit of science chat.
Cool. Awesome. I will let you go. I appreciate you coming on. You're fantastic. You're just doing a wonderful job in the space.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram, @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.